How wonderful to see so many of you, both in the Zendo and out there in the Maha Zendo that Zoom provides us with. And I hope the folks out there in the Maha Zendo are appreciating seeing the folks here in the Zendo. It makes you feel a little bit more connected and part of the Maha Sangha that has been one surprising result of these months of pandemic, is that folks can connect across distance in Sangha better. And so we'll continue with that as we go forward. How are you hearing back there?
Oh, good.
Good. Let me know if I fade. This is our second day of our opening weekend, second day of our practice period. Many of you were here yesterday for Michael's introductory talk, but some of you weren't. And I think you all probably know that our theme for this year's practice period, we're calling Right Relationship, Healing and Nurturing Connection. And for the very reasons that Michael talked about yesterday, that we are in this kind of in-between place. We're still in the pandemic, but we're moving into a new phase of reconfiguring our relational worlds, really, learning how to do it in this in-between space. And so it feels maybe good to inquire into that together, and at all the different sort of expanding concentric circles of relationships, from our own body and mind to those closest to us, to our communities, to the world, right on out, to all beings. So there's no text for this practice period. The text is the book of your lives, you know. And of course, there are lots of Dharma resources to draw on, and we will be doing so. And so please graze freely in the Dharma fields, but let that also extend to fiction, art, poetry, film. See what you observe about relationship in the world around you. Not so much news. Maybe just take a little, you know, step back from the news, not completely perhaps, but really limit, really, really limit, and expand to these other forms of human expression that have more heart, and that speak the Dharma to us in many ways. Yeah? Human relationships are not easy at the best of times, and these have not been the best of times. We blunder in so many ways, often with the best of intentions. I'd like to start today with a reading from the great American novelist, poet, essayist, farmer, and environmental activist. Anybody guess with that preamble who it might be?
Wendell Berry.
You got it. Wendell Berry. Wendell Berry. He's, oh gosh, I looked up, I believe he's probably in his early 80s, but I don't trust my memory. I did look it up. And this is from a 1990 collection of essays called What Are People For? Good question. We might think, we may have asked ourselves, what? You know, we've made such a mess on this planet, you know, and we're so horrible to each other, you know, over the millennia, you know, what is this human project all about? Why are we here? Well, the Buddhist answer to that question would be to awaken. We have just enough self-consciousness as big-brained apes to convince ourselves that we're the center of the universe. And our practice of awakening is to see beyond that narrow horizon for the benefit of all beings, for the benefit of the earth. Some of Barry's essays, 1990, in a way that doesn't seem that long ago, and then I went, oh, that was a long time ago. It depends on your perspective. But some of his essays seem rather quaint, like, why I am not going to buy a computer. But this, his opening essay or pair of essays form a kind of parable for our human dilemma of right relationship. The first is titled Damage, and the second is titled Healing. Barry's work is deeply rooted in the land of Kentucky, where he has farmed for decades and where his family farmed for generations before. So he begins this section, and these are they're in the form of short paragraphs or even sentences. This is just one section. I have a steep wooded hillside that I wanted to be able to pasture occasionally, but had no permanent water supply. About halfway to the top of the slope, there's a narrow bench on which I thought I could make a small pond. I hired a man with a bulldozer to dig one. He cleared away the trees and then formed the pond, cutting into the hill on the upper side, piling the loosened dirt in a curving earthwork on the lower. The pond appeared to be a success. Before the bulldozer quit work, water had already begun to seep in. Soon there was enough to support a few head of stock. That means cows, right? Cattle. To heal the exposed ground, I fertilized it and sowed it with grass and clover. We had an extremely wet fall and winter, with the usual freezing and thawing. The ground grew heavy with water and soft. The earthwork slumped. A large slice of the woods floor on the upper side slipped down into the pond. The trouble was the familiar one. Too much power, too little knowledge. The fault was mine. I was careful to get expert advice, but this only exemplifies what I already knew. No expert knows everything about every place. Not even everything about any place. I'm going to say that again because it really, no expert knows everything about every place, not even everything about any place. If one's knowledge of one's whereabouts is insufficient, if one's judgment is unsound, then expert advice is of little use. How many of us have taken on a task or an initiative in a relationship, in our family, our work, with a friend or a lover, in our garden or the wild, with the best of intentions, and somehow it just didn't go as we hoped or intended. Somehow it got contaminated by one of the three poisons: greed, hatred, or ignorance. Pretty much everything we do gets a little contaminated. Right? Louder? Thank you. The earthwork of the pond collapses. The relationship boundary we thought we set carefully was breached. The advice we offered our friend was forcibly rejected. The plan we'd proposed was dismissed. We didn't get it right. On the other hand, sometimes it feels like we're on the receiving end of someone else's blundering, someone else's controlling or criticizing. We feel the sting of the poison arrows of their greed, hatred, aversion, or ignorance. More often than not, the hours are flying both ways. The Buddha called these ouch points darts. The first dart is the ouch of something you feel stung by. It could be anything from an actual bee sting to your neighbor's barking dog to sharp words from your spouse. And then the second dart is your reaction. Most often it comes almost immediately after the first, right? Ah, what do you mean? That's not true. The first dart starts a cascade of neurophysiological reactions in your brain and your body, pumping stress hormones and signaling your organs and your muscles to get ready for action, right? To respond to the threat. You're keyed up. You're ready to fight or flight, or if neither of those options are possible, to freeze. If your previous experience has been of helplessness, you might freeze even when there are other options. Or if your previous habit pattern has been fight or flight, you might reactively switch into that mode even when it's not at all necessary. Right? We've probably all done variations of those patterns. Now, second darts are often followed by third darts. So third dart is, oh my God, I did that again. You know, I reacted that way again. Yeah, so first dart, the ouch. Second dart, reaction. Third dart, judgment about the reaction. Right. And fourth darts, you know. In relationships, our second dart reactions can trigger second darts in the other person. And pretty soon you've got just darts flying back and forth. And you've lost count. These darts can open wounds and leave scars, just as Wendell Berry's botched plan wounded the earth of his farm. But the capacity for healing is inherent in living systems, in our bodies, our minds, and the earth. And we maybe will talk more, there's much more we can say about how we can attend to those darts and catch them sooner, you know, and do damage control. And believe me, better late than not at all. But let's go back to Barry's words. He says, in general, I have used my farm carefully. It could be said, I think, that I have improved it more than I have damaged it. It's what we all hope for, isn't it? My aim has been to go against its history and to repair the damage of other people. And again, that's what we hope we can do over generations of human karma. But now a part of its damage is my own. The pond was a modest piece of work, and so the damage is not extensive. In the course of time and nature, it will heal. And yet there is damage to my place and to me. I have carried out before my own eyes and against my intention a part of the modern tragedy. I have made a lasting flaw in the face of the earth for no lasting good. Until that wound in the hillside, my place, is healed, there will be something impaired in my mind. My peace is damaged. I will not be able to forget it. When I read this, I thought, he's talking like a bodhisattva. Until the suffering of all beings is healed, I too remain wounded. Like the story of Vimalakirti, the legendary enlightened layman of the time of the Buddha, whose teachings are given in the Vimalakirti Sutra. This is just a tiny part of the story, but Vimalakirti, the setting is Vimalakirti is laying ill in his tiny little room, and the Buddha sends all of his most distinguished disciples along with a host of bodhisattvas to pay a sick call on Vimalakirti. They all crowd into the little room. Somehow they all fit, this huge, huge number of beings. But they're all too intimidated by Vimalakirti's great wisdom and reputation as a teacher to inquire about his illness. And the Buddha keeps encouraging each one, and each one says, no, I can't. I can't possibly approach Vimalakirti. And then they tell a long story of the teachings that Vimalakirti gave. So it goes on and on, until finally Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, agrees to summon up his courage and approach Vimalakirti and asks him about his illness. What is the cause of your illness, and how can it be healed? And Vimalakirti replies, this illness of mine is born of ignorance and the feelings of attachment. Because all living beings are sick, therefore I am sick. If all living beings are relieved of sickness, then my sickness will be mended. Because the bodhisattva, for the sake of living beings, enters the realm of birth and death, and because he is in the realm of birth and death, he suffers illness. If living beings can gain release from illness, then the bodhisattva will no longer be ill. This illness, Vimalakirti's illness, that he's sharing, holding with all beings, is the delusion, is the illness of delusion that Michael talked about yesterday, that causes us so much suffering. But even us apprentice bodhisattvas have felt the pain of suffering beings over these long months, haven't we? Not just our own, right? But so many kinds of suffering in the world that we have felt. And we have felt our own complicity in the damage that our human greed, aversion, and ignorance has done to each other and to the environment, the world around us. Our sense of peace, ease, and security has been jeopardized. When we interact so much with via electronic media, with the talking heads on Zoom screens, we miss out on the body language, the hugs, the shared tea and cookies. How long has it been since we've had tea and cookies here in the Zendo, right? These things that take the sting away from the darts that cushion and comfort us in our blundering. And so a neutral facial expression on Zoom appears hostile. A teasing remark stings like a dart. It's hard enough to negotiate communication in human relationships under normal circumstances. No wonder people say it's easier with their dogs and cats. But months of relative social distancing have made it harder for many of us. We know wounds of separation and damage in relationship can fester for years and infect other relationships and undermine our confidence. So, healing. What is healing? Remember, Michael made the distinction yesterday between curing, fixing what's wrong, and healing, making whole. Some other words are restoration, rehabilitation, reconciliation, recollection, reconfiguration. Notice they all have re. Again. We have to do this work or practice of mending relationships again and again and again throughout our lives. So here's where the scaffolding of our practice comes in to help us. Michael talked about the Four Noble Truths, and the Eightfold Path is the fourth. It's the way. The Buddha offers us a way to live in a world of suffering, a way of awakening. Now, right relationship is not one of the Eightfold Path, is it? But isn't it implicit that our entire practice that is a practice of right relationship? So just a brief survey of the Eightfold Path to give us the sort of overall picture. Right view or understanding helps us see the truth of what in Buddhist teaching are called the three seals, or I like to call them the Buddhist facts of life. Anicca, impermanence, anatta, non-self, and dukkha, suffering or dissatisfaction. When we deeply see these truths, we understand that relationships are a process, a dynamic, ever-changing, interpenetrating connection. And when we suffer when we resist that reality of impermanence and no separate self. When we set ourselves in an oppositional me against the world stance and insist that the world should go the way I want it to go. And people in my life should behave in the way I want them to. Right intention, the next of the Eightfold, helps us remember over and over again why we need to pay attention, why we want to be free from greed, hatred, and delusion, so that we and others can be free from suffering. This is our bodhisattva vow, so this is right intention. Right speech, conduct, and livelihood give us that on-the-ground practice for being in the world, in relationship. They all have to do with relationship, right? Those of you who are familiar with the 10 grave precepts of the 16 bodhisattva precepts will remember that 3 of the 10 have to do with speech, right? Because speech gets us into so much trouble. So the precepts are such a great support in our relational lives. And then comes right effort, which applies both to our meditation practice and to our relational lives. Not too tight, not too slack, right? And then right mindfulness and right concentration in tandem, strengthened by our practice, our zazen practice, are what help us pay attention to every aspect of our lives in relationship. Right? Because if we're only half there, if we're not paying attention, we'll mess up. They help us to notice when we feel those darts and notice our reaction right away, you know, get in there so that we can just take that step back, open some space, and respond in a more kind and patient and wise way. So right mindfulness and right concentration help us notice that ouch of the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Does that sound familiar? That's the great soliloquy by Hamlet from Shakespeare, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Hamlet was wondering whether it's better to suffer those slings and arrows or to check out. You know, he's flirting with the idea of death. You're like, this is just too hard. Can I just get out of here? Right? You know, most of us have felt that way at some point. And then, as opposed to fighting, you know, fighting all the time. Yeah, he wonders, is it better to suffer the sting or to take arms against a sea of troubles? And he says, no, he knows that's futile. And then he considers death. Is that a way to escape the trials of human life? which he lists the whips and scorns of time, the oppressor's wrong, the proud man's contumely. Contumely is disparaging of others in word or action. An old-fashioned word. The proud man's contumely, the pangs of despised love, the law's delay. You know, they sound pretty contemporary. If you get past the language, we're still, those are the slings and arrows that are still flying today. And we could each make a list from the past months. There'd probably be a fair amount of overlap. But then Hamlet realizes that he's afraid of what comes after death, and that he would rather bear those ills, he says, than fly to others that we know not of, meaning what comes after death. But maybe we have another option for the dilemma of suffering besides putting up with it because we're afraid of what comes next after we die. The Buddha gives us this beautiful scaffolding of practice to support our awakening to the true nature of our existence. And in that patient, lifelong cultivation, we can experience liberation right in the midst of this wide, beautiful, messy, awful world. And liberation might come in a blinding flash, but if it does, watch out, because it won't last. But it also comes in increments. Faithfully practicing, it comes in increments, sometimes so subtle that you're not patting on yourself on the back saying, oh, I got it, I'm enlightened now, because you're so fully present in that simple, vivid moment of life just as it is. Whether it's a spectacular sunset over the Pacific Ocean, or sitting beside someone you love as they take their last breaths. Our dharmic practice gives us a kind of toolkit with so many possibilities, like the thousand arms of Kannon Bodhisattva, holding a tool for each suffering being. There's the Eightfold Path, there are the paramitas, which we studied last year during practice period. Generosity, morality, patience, energy, concentration, and wisdom. There are the Brahma-viharas, or noble abodes, loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, and joy. All of these practices support right relationship. And maybe we'll pull some from the toolkit as we go along through this practice period. But they're only tools, right? And they're not one tool for every use, and not every person uses all of them. Maybe we could think of it more as a medicine cabinet instead of a toolkit, or even a medicine pouch. You know how indigenous peoples often have or shamans often have a pouch with healing objects inside. So you might want to generate a kind of either internal, imaginary medicine pouch to touch into with your own set. You might even want to make one. You might even want to make one and put some things in. I know what I'd put. I might put a lapis stone, because that's the healing Buddha stone, or an owl feather for wisdom and seeing in the dark. What would you put in your medicine pouch? It might be a word or phrase. The Zen tradition also contributes to the medicine pouch with stories and phrases and images from the Zen ancestors and literature. You might remember when we began this year knowing we were still, you know, partway through the winter and more pandemic to come. And so we generated the idea for two qualities that we wanted to offer to the Sangha for the new year. And one was Fudo Shin, Unmoving Mind. Remember this? We put it on the web. It's still probably on the website, so where you can download a copy and print it out if you want. This says Fudo Shin. Shin is this in this one. It's inside the Enso. Can you see that, folks? Yeah. Fudo Shin means literally unmoving heart mind, but steadfast is the sense of it. Steadfastness. So we needed steadfastness, and we also needed great healing. So we made a pair. Right. Dai Yi, this is Flo's Dharma name. So for the practice period, we have another one for you. A Zen phrase that we found that goes Anshin Ritsume. So Anshin means peaceful heart, easeful heart. Here, I'll hold it up for the Zoom people. And Ritsu means standing, Mei means life, so upright life. So this is an open, easeful heart and a upright, firm core spine, that combination. We'll talk more about, there's some neurophysiology of this too, but we'll talk about that later. So, And then these, you'll see the background of these. These are rubbings from tree bark. See? So this is your phrase for the practice period, Anshin Ritsume, peaceful heart, upright life. Here's one more. It's hard to decide which one, so I put all three. Often our hearts have been troubled and anxious, fearful and grieving. And now we need to allow our hearts ease and peace. Allow them to heal with that inherent healing power that life has. Nurtured by the restorative power of connection with the earth, mountains, rivers, birds, trees, and each other. Not just talking heads in Zoom boxes, but living, breathing, embodied human beings. Beginning carefully to share tea and cookies again. At the same time, we need that core strength to stand upright, not to be toppled when things get unsteady. Not to be propped up by rigid beliefs and doctrines, but with the flexibility of a living tree or a bamboo. So strongly rooted, the bamboo, and yet so flexible. I've told you this before, but in Japan, they say that a bamboo grove is the safest place to be in an earthquake. People would run to the bamboo grove. You might want to check out Kay's lunch hour movement and meditation class starting next week. If you want to kind of physically practice what we're talking about here. You know, soft and open front, strong core, right? You can't just think your way to healing. So, going back to Wendell Berry's dilemma, to see what he has to say in his second section called Healing, which is really more just a kind of a series of phrases or aphorisms almost. So I'm just going to read part of this almost as a contemplation. So I want you to, I'll just read slowly, and I just want you to receive these words. When words come to us as poetry, they can penetrate to the heart of the matter, at least as best as words can. So please allow these words to touch you. The grace that is the health of creatures can only be held in common. In healing, the scattered members come together. In health, the flesh is graced, the holy enters the world. Or we might say the holy that is always there becomes we experience it. There is the pride of thinking oneself without teachers. The teachers are everywhere. What is wanted is a learner. In ignorance is hope. Okay, we're going to just tweak that in Zen language. Just substitute not knowing. That's what he means when he says ignorance here. So I'll do that. I'm going to substitute. In not knowing is hope. If we had known the difficulty, we would not have learned even so little. Rely on not knowing. It is not knowing the teachers will come to. They are waiting, as they always have, beyond the edge of the light. The teachings of unsuspected teachers belong to the task and are its hope. The love and the work of friends and lovers belong to the task and are its health. Rest and rejoicing belong to the task and are its grace. Let tomorrow come tomorrow. Not by your will is the house carried through the night. Not by your will is the house carried through the night. So thank you, everyone, for your practice this weekend. And I'm really looking forward to practicing with each and every one of you in the coming weeks, just as much as you're able to join in. Please don't no guilt, absolutely no guilt. Just practice in whatever way you can, and make this practice period part of your life. Make this practice period your life. Your life is the book of this practice period, and you are in the Mahasangha practicing with all of us. Yeah.
Page 3.
May our